You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello, I'm Ian Leslie. I'm an author and journalist, and I'm delighted to welcome you all today for today's talk. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's special guest speaker, David Brooks. David has been called the essential columnist of our time, and his New York Times column attracts millions of readers worldwide. His best-selling books include the influential Bobos in Paradise, On Paradise Drive, and The Social Animal. In 2013, he began teaching a course on philosophical humility at Yale University, from which some of the ideas explored in his latest book, The Road to Character, originated. And my personal point of view, it's a great honour and pleasure to introduce David. I think he is unsurpassed at what he does. He's the finest columnist in the world, as far as I'm concerned, and has been for years, to me, a source of great stimulation and provocation on a regular basis. So it really is a particular honour to welcome you here today, David, and without further ado, over to you.
Thank you for an extraordinarily kind introduction. I'll be writing down that key sentence in there. It's a pleasure to be here. It's always a pleasure to be in England. I grew up in a very Anglophilic household. When Jews came to America, they decided the way to fit in was to ape all things British, and there was a slogan, think Yiddish, act British. And so one of the things they did was they gave their children, their sons, English names so no one would think they were Jewish. And so they named them Irving, Sidney, Norman, Milton. And immediately they became Jewish names. So that part didn't really work. But my father wrote books on John Ruskin. My mother wrote a book on Wimbledon Common. We house-swapped with Margaret Drabble. They sent me to an Anglican school called Grace Church School in Lower Manhattan, where I was part of the all-Jewish boys' davening choir at Grace, where we'd sing the hymns. But we were about 50% Jewish, and to square it with our religion, we just wouldn't sing the word Jesus. And so the volume would drop down on the hymns. And so it was sort of a winding road. My parents were somewhat left-wing, and they took me in 1966 to a be-in, where hippies would go just to be. And it was in Central Park, and one of the things they did was they set a garbage can on fire and threw their wallets into it to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I was five, and I saw a $5 bill on fire in the garbage can, so I broke from the crowd, reached into the flames, and ran away with the money, which was my first step over to the right. And now I've wound up as sort of the center-right columnist of the New York Times, a job I liken to being the chief rabbi at Mecca. Not always a lot of company there. But so there are twists and turns in a life, and this book emerges out of twists and turns. And some of them are just moments of moral inspiration. And sometimes we have moments of moral inspiration when we're surrounded by nature. Some people have them in churches and in synagogues. But sometimes you have them when you're surrounded by a person who's incandescent, who radiates an inner life which you want to live up to and be like. And so about a year ago, I was at a Washington think tank, and I was seated next to the Dalai Lama at a luncheon. And he's the sort of person who radiates just this glow. And he laughs unexpectedly for no apparent reason. He's so happy. And when you're dining with him, you feel compelled, out of politeness, to laugh along with him for no apparent reason. And you also feel compelled to justify the laughter by inserting something that might be joke-like, in order so it makes sense. And so I was sitting nervously with him, and he was laughing, and I was laughing. I said, and he has a little Dalai Lama bag, a canvas bag he carries stuff in. And so I said, do you got any candy in there? I just didn't know what to say. And so he started pulling stuff out of the bag, and it was basically everything you get in the first class cabin of an international flight. And so it's the eye shades, the ear pad, you know, the ear thing, his little razor, and a big Toblerone bar. And so when you're surrounded by such people, there's just a glow there. And he's famous, but I was up in a place called Frederick, Maryland, with some ladies who teach immigrants English and then how to read. And this process could take 7 years. And I went in and met about 30 of them. And as soon as you walk in the room, they radiate a sort of a kindness and a gentleness and a glow. It's just a gratitude and a happiness, a simple happiness. And my reaction on such moments is that I've achieved way more career success than I ever thought I would. But when you see that inner light, that glow, that kindness, my reaction is, well, I haven't achieved that. And so I would like to achieve that in life. You only get one life. You'd like to not only have a career that's estimable, but also have that inner glow. And so the way I thought about it and the way I opened the book is with this distinction between two sets of virtues, which you might call the eulogy virtues and the resume virtues. And the resume or the CV virtues here are the things that make you good at your job, whether you're good at math, whether you're good at physics, whether you have communication skills. And the eulogy virtues are the things they say about you after you're dead, whether you're honest, courageous, straightforward, capable of great love. And we'd all want to lead a life where the eulogy virtues are more important. We'd all want to be remembered for those. But we live in a society and certainly an educational system that spends a lot more time on the CV virtues. And a lot of us are more clear on how to build a good career than how to build a good inner character. And so the book was really an attempt to figure out that second path. And it was guided by a book I read named Lonely Man of Faith, which was written in 1965 by Joseph Soloveitchik. And Soloveitchik argues that there's two sides of our nature, what he calls the Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the CV side, the external side, who wants to build and create things. Adam 2 is the internal side. Adam 2 wants to embody certain moral qualities, have a solid sense of right and wrong, not only to do good, but to be good inside. And so Adam 1 wants to conquer the world. Adam 2 wants to obey a calling and serve the world. Adam 1 asks how things work. Adam 2 asks why things exist and what ultimately we're here for. Adam 1 wants to venture forth. Adam 2 wants to return to the warmth of a family meal, drinks with friends. And so Soloveitchik's point is that these two Adams sometimes go together. Sometimes having a great inner character does help you in your career, helps you build relationships. But sometimes there's a confrontation between the two. And I'd say the essence of this confrontation is that these two Adams live by different logics. That Adam 1 lives by an economic logic. Adam 1 lives in the world, in the market. And the logic is straightforward. Input leads to output, effort leads to reward, practice makes perfect. Adam 2 lives not in the market, but in the realm of the morals. And moral logic is different from economic logic, and it's filled with inversions and paradoxes. You have to surrender to something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to give to receive. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success can lead to the greatest failure, which is arrogance and pride. Failure can lead to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. And so the key is to have a balance between the two. And I would say, in my own life and in the culture at large, we have gotten out of balance. And if you're overwhelmingly Adam 1, in my view, you turn into a shrewd animal, a little too utilitarian, a little too calculating. You live with sort of an unconscious boredom, not really connected to highest ideals. You settle for a sort of moral mediocrity where you grade yourself on a forgiving curve. You think, well, people seem to like me. I don't obviously hurt anybody. But a core piece of yourself day by day becomes a little less impressive than you would have hoped. You don't deserve the eulogy that you would like, and you don't radiate that inner light that those ladies in Frederick. And so, as I say, I think we live in a culture that is two Adam one. And it's in part because we're taught to brand ourselves. We live in a competitive world. It just takes a lot of time to have a good career, so we spend a lot of our resources on that. Second, we live in a world of social media where you broadcast yourself, you go for likes. I was sitting next to a young woman on the plane who spent the 2 hours of her flight looking at her phone, looking at videos of herself, pulling faces, and a level of self-interest that is unusual. And we've had a generation, a shift in moral philosophy from a culture that said you're broken inside, you have to work on your own weakness. We've gone to a culture that says you're pretty wonderful inside. and the cliches of what we tell our young, follow your passion, be true to yourself, trust yourself, love yourself, have created an enlarged sense of self. And we've told a couple generations how great they are, and they've believed us. And so in 1950, a polling organization asked American 16-year-olds, are you a very important person? And at that point, 12% said yes. They asked the same question in the 1990s, and at that point, 80% said yes. Psychologists have a thing called the narcissism test, where they say, I'm going to read you a bunch of statements. Does this apply to you? And those statements include things like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so remarkable. Or, somebody should write a biography about me. I love to look at my body. And the median narcissism score has gone up 30% over the last 20 years. And with this has gone an increased desire for fame. Fame used to rank at the bottom of what people wanted out of life. Now it ranks second or third after financial security. And so junior high school girls in the U.S., about 13-year-old girls were asked, would you rather be a celebrity's personal assistant, Justin Bieber's personal assistant, or president of Harvard? And by 3-1, they'd rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. Though to be fair, I asked the president of Harvard, and she would rather be Justin Bieber's personal assistant. College students is my favorite one. College students were asked, would you like to lead a life that involves a lot of fame or a life that involves a lot of sex? And by 2-1, they say, I want the life of fame. And I go to college campus, and I say, listen, I'm on TV twice a week. I write for a prominent newspaper. I'm kind of famous. Go with the sex. It's a lot better. But the more serious effect is that people lose the capacity to conduct a sophisticated moral conversation. I don't think people are necessarily bad, but I think they're morally inarticulate. A sociologist named Christian Smith went around to the states and asked people, can you name your last moral dilemma? And 70% of them couldn't name a moral dilemma. They'd say, I pulled into a parking space, but I didn't have any money. And he would say, that's sort of a problem. It's not really a moral dilemma. And he said they were good people. They just had not been given the moral vocabulary to have that conversation. Google engrams help us measure the word usages across the English-speaking world. And we can tell by looking at all the magazines, all the newspapers, and all the books that get published, what words are being used. And over the last generation, economic words have been rising in frequency. Moral words have been dropping. So usage of the word bravery is down 66%. Gratitude is down 49%. Humbleness is down 52%. And kindness is down 56%. We're just talking about this stuff less. And we're talking about economics more. And so I felt, you know, I just want to know how moral life develops. And I did it through a series, and I'm not a philosopher, so I didn't do it through abstract philosophy. I did it through looking at people. And I do think we learn from each other. And I wanted to know what are the activities that lead to moral depth. And so I looked at people who were kind of pathetic at age 20, but kind of magnificent by age 70. And I just want to know what activities they had. And just for the last 7 or 8 minutes, I'll mention some of the people and some of the activities. The first person I studied was Dwight Eisenhower. When Eisenhower was 8 or 9, he wanted to go trick-or-treating on Halloween, and his mother wouldn't let him. So he threw a temper tantrum and punched a tree in the front yard, and he punched it so bad that he rubbed all the skin off his fingers. And his mom sent him to his room and had him cry for an hour, and she came up to him, she bound his wounds, and she recited a verse. And that verse was, he that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city. And 60 years later, Eisenhower said that was the most important conversation of his life. It taught him two things. First, it taught him humility. And humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. Humility is radical self-awareness from a distance. It's the ability to see your strengths, but also your weaknesses. And so he came to realize he had a core weakness, which was his temper. And the second thing she taught him was that the essential drama of life is not the external climb to success, it's the internal confrontation against your own weakness. And that every decision you make, you turn that core self into something slightly higher or something lower. And so he spent the rest of his life combating his own temper, combating his passion, and combating what was a sour temperament. During World War II, when he was living here, we think of him as this garrulous country club kind of guy, but he was upset with at nights with anxiety attacks, insomnia, drinking, blood pressure spiking, roiled in hatred. But he knew he could not lead from a position of anxiety and anger. He had to lead from cheerfulness and confidence. And so he constructed a persona. And some of the things he did were quite shallow. He would take the names of the people he hated, write them down on pieces of paper, and rip them up and throw them in the garbage can just as a way to purge. But over the course of his life, he turned himself strong in his weakest spots. And that was that capacity for self-defeat and self-conquest is one of the steps onto depth. The second we'd say is suffering. We wouldn't call someone deep if they hadn't endured moments of suffering. And my example of that is Samuel Johnson. He was born, he barely survived the ordeal of his birth. He was infected with tuberculosis by his nursemaid, which rendered him blind in one eye, deaf in one ear. He developed smallpox. They opened a wound in his arm to bleed him. This is the 18th century, and they kept the wound open for 6 years. He developed what we think was Tourette's syndrome, OCD, and he suffered. He suffered really up till 30. He went to Oxford, dropped out after a year, became a teacher, and failed immediately. And so by 30, as he said, he led a life that was radically wretched. Now, sometimes people shrivel when they suffer. But Johnson did the things that are necessary to turn suffering into something larger and something enlarging. The first thing suffering did was it introduced him to himself. The theologian Paul Tillich says that what suffering does is it takes you beneath the everydayness of life and reminds you you're not who you thought you were. Moments of suffering when you lose a loved one or have a romantic breakup, they carve into what you thought was the floor of the basement of your soul, and they carve below it, revealing a cavity below, and they carve through that, revealing a cavity below. And so from suffering, Johnson developed great self-knowledge. The second thing suffering can do is it can increase empathy as those you develop more sympathy for those who are also in suffering. And the third thing it does is it can lead to transcendence. When people suffer, they have an instinct to turn their moment of suffering, to connect it to a larger narrative of redemption. I have friends who lost a kid at age 6, and they didn't say, well, we've suffered a lot, we should now go and party to balance things off. They created a foundation to turn the death of their child into a narrative of transcendence and redemption. And so Johnson came here, he became a freelance writer and then a writer, and he was armed with the capacity of self-knowledge, and he wrote about himself. He wrote moral essays for The Rambler, called The Rambler, on sorrow, on envy, and all the things that were characterized him, his weak spots. He had tremendous capacity for empathy. At his home near Fleet Street, he gathered in strays, a former slave, a former prostitute, people who had nowhere else to go, but they lived with him, and he housed them. And then he solidified himself. He couldn't control his body, he couldn't control his mind, but he took his writing and made it a moral occasion to anchor himself in the reality of the truth. And he shows us through that suffering, intellectual inquiry can be a moment of great, a moral act and a solidifying. And so by the time he died, he was recognized as this great, substantial, solid person, which is the opposite of what he was at age 30. So he teaches us suffering and intellectual inquiry as a moral vocation. The third person I'll mention is a woman named Frances Perkins. In her 20s, she's an American. She was born around 1880. She, as a young woman, she wanted to do good in the world, but was unfocused. So she worked at a settlement house for the poor in Chicago. She combated sex trafficking in Philadelphia. She moved to New York, but was sort of unfocused. She's having tea one day in 1911, and she hears a commotion outside. And she rushes out, and she sees a fire, one of the most famous fires in American history, called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. She rushes up to the building, and she sees out of the 10th floor window what she thinks are people throwing bundles of clothing out the window. But in fact, it's like 9/11. People are choosing to leap to their deaths as opposed to getting burned to death. She sees 47 people go over. There's a guy holding the seamstresses across the windowsill and dropping them into space, a second, a third, a fourth, who's his girlfriend, who he kisses, drops her, and then he goes over. And that moment was what you might call her call within a call. She had this vocation. She knew she wanted to do good, but she was unfocused. And in that moment, it all turned into a focus, and she became an instrument for the rest of her life, for 50 years, in the cause of worker safety. And she quieted herself. She became a little ruthless. She would compromise with anybody, work with anybody to advance this cause. And so that's how a vocation happens. We tell young people, find your passion, look within yourself. But most young people do not have a passion. They can't look within themselves and find the answer there. The better thing is, instead of saying, what do I want from life, the better thing, as Perkins did, was say, what is life demanding of me? What are the circumstances I'm in asking me to do? And that is how she found her vocation. The fourth thing I'll mention is we wouldn't say someone had depth and character if they weren't capable of great love. And the person I use to illustrate the capacity for love is George Eliot, the great novelist, who grew up to a mother who was ill and could not provide love for her. So she grew up emotionally very, very needy. And she would fall in love with any man she met, tall, short, old, young, married, unmarried. She'd fall for a guy. She'd entrance her with her conversation, and then his wife would throw her out of the house. That was a typical pattern. She fell for a guy, a great philosopher named Herbert Spencer, when she was 32. And she wrote him a letter that was at once pathetic and also impressive. And the letter was pathetic in that she's begging him to marry her. It's like, please, please marry me. You won't notice me. I'll be around the house. I won't cause you any trouble. If you don't marry me, I'll die. But then in the end, she writes the following. I suppose no woman ever before wrote such a letter as this. But I am not ashamed, for I am conscious in the light of reason and true refinement that I am worthy of your respect and tenderness, whatever gross men or vulgar-minded women might say of me. And there's the moment that happens, I think, in most people in their early 30s, where they stop being reliant on other people's affirmation or criticism. They develop their own internal criteria to measure themselves and how they're doing. And that was her moment. And so it didn't work with Spencer, but she fell for this guy, George Lewis, who was already married. His wife was estranged, had borne three children with another man. And she was confronted with the choice. Do I go with Lewis, in which case she'll be labeled an adulteress and cast out of society, or do I forsake him and just live a normal life? She decided to go with Lewis, and she took a daring leap of love, and that was what paid off for her. And so when we think of someone who's been solidified by love and who's been transformed by love, the first thing love does is it humbles you. When you're in love, you're not in control of your own mind. You've got intrusive thoughts about your beloved. The second thing it does is it plows open hard ground, revealing soft flesh, which makes you more vulnerable to suffering and to joy. The third thing it does is it decenters the self. It reminds you that your riches are in another and not in yourself. And the fourth thing it does is it fuses people together. So as Montaigne said, love eliminates the distinction between giving and receiving. When you give a gift to your beloved, you're giving to a piece of yourself. And so it's more pleasurable to give than to receive. And so she made this daring leap. And she did get cut off. And yet it paid off for her. She had a long and more or less happy relationship with Lewis. About a year into the relationship, he says to her, you might try your hand at fiction. You might be good at it. And so she goes away for a week, writes a short story, reads it to him aloud, and by the middle of the story, he's weeping because he knows what she has, the talent she has. His love in some ways is more impressive. He surrenders his career to hers, puts her first, becomes her agent, her editor, her publicist. She's very sensitive to criticism. He gets up early in the morning, goes through the papers, reads for her name, and if he sees her name mentioned in any article, he cuts it out so she won't have to see it. And that is a life that was pathetic and needy, but was solidified by love. And so these are just some of the activities that I think would lead us to our depth. People have taken the normal occasions of life and turned them into moral events. Whether it's self-defeat, whether it's suffering, whether it's humility, whether it's finding vocation or falling in love. And the people who have lived these lives are in a different culture than we're in, or at least is prevalent today. We live in a culture, a romantic culture. We think we're wonderful inside and the problems of society are outside. These people did not believe that. They thought the problems are mostly within. And they worked on combating that. And that is how character is built, through that internal confrontation. And some of it was hard, but some of it was joyful, because you don't do it alone. You can't do it alone. We all need redemptive assistance from outside, so they bound themselves with others. And they had a great sense of camaraderie and love and companionship. And then they had moments of joy, that inner light that I saw in the ladies in Frederick. And so the last person I'll mention is St. Augustine, who was born in 354 in northern Africa to a mom named Monica, who's the helicopter mom to beat all helicopter moms. And so she wanted to control his thoughts, his faith, who he married, what he believed, what he did. He tricks her and gets on a boat to Italy to get away from her. She's screaming at the shore. She gets on the next boat, tracks him down in Italy. And so they had a life of conflict. But then at the end of his life, at the end of her life, she's in her late 50s, and he's had his conversion. She says to him, you know, all my life I've wanted to be this sort of man, this sort of Christian, and now you are that. And so she says to him, my work here is done. I'm ready to die. In fact, 9 days later, she does die. And he describes their final conversation in a garden. And after a life of conflict, they have this harmonious, lovely conversation where he says their voices merged and they rose above themselves into the realm of pure spirit. And then he has a long sentence that's hard to parse, but it has a word that it repeats itself through there. And in some translations, that word is hushed. He says, the sound of our voices became hushed. The sound of the trees and the wind in it was hushed. The sound of the birds was hushed. The sound of our hearts was hushed. And you finally get this sense of this great tranquility and quiet. And the ambitions of Adam 1 are never satisfied. There's always more to reach for. But Adam 2, the moral life, does have moments of just restfulness. And out of that restfulness comes a delight in life, a sense of gratitude, and the inner light that I think we were all born and wired to seek. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Fascinating talk. I just want to start off by talking a bit about the kind of book it is. Your previous work, you've drawn on a lot of social science, particularly sociology and psychology, and you've kind of woven the narratives around that. With this one, you pretty much have dropped the science, and the book is really structured around a series of exemplary biographies. So I just wanted to ask you about that decision.
Yeah. So, you know, the Owl of Minerva flies at dusk. You only understand what you're doing after you've done it.
Yeah.
And so each of my books, in retrospect, are about the same demographic, one level down. And so I wrote about Bobos in Paradise was about consumerism, then residential patterns, then psychology, and now moral philosophy.
Yeah.
So it's gone down. I don't know what's next, like real estate or something. That's really, really important. But frankly, I wrote this book, The Social Animal, which was about a lot of social science research and neuroscience, and I became dissatisfied with it. And I expected we're in the really great neuroscientific revolution. We're learning so much more about the brain. But it wasn't teaching me that much, I found. We're learning about the neural mechanisms for a lot of human behavior, but we always knew some mechanism was there. Whether it happens in this part of the brain or that part of the brain, I don't really care. And so to be honest, I was a little dissatisfied with a lot of the stuff I was learning from neuroscience.
And just in terms of the different people you write about, I wonder if you could talk about how you felt about them. Because I got the impression as a reader that there were some of these people that you deeply admired and drew you know, great insights from how they lived. And then there were others whom you admired but also loved. So I would say, you know, you admired Eisenhower or Marshall, but you loved Samuel Johnson. And there's a sort of joy in your writing about Johnson over and above the admiration.
Marshall is a completely wonderful, admirable man. He's hard to love.
Yeah.
He's emotionally self-controlled. When he was lecturing in the Wharf College, and he got a call, and he was called into a side room, and he picked up the phone, and he put his head on the desk, and his aide said, General Marshall, is there something wrong? And Marshall said, no, I've just learned, Mr. Throckmorton, that my wife, who was to join me today, has just died. And so there's an emotional control there that is too austere for me. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you who I loved the most. I loved Eliot. I loved Johnson. And Augustine is amazing. Mm. And I teach this, as you mentioned, at a class at Yale. And there's a person I haven't mentioned, Dorothy Day.
Yes.
And so she was a great Catholic social worker, did food shelter or food kitchens and homeless shelters and things. And she wrote a book called The Long Loneliness, and it's one of the 14 books I teach in the class. And so there are 14 books, there are 24 students in the seminar, and the final assignment is pick any of the 14 books and use it to address a problem in your own life. And last term, out of the 24 students, 19 picked The Long Loneliness by Dorothy Day. And that's because she has an emotional intensity to her life and an earnest desire to really be a good person, and is so self-aware that people are just gripped by her. And that intensity, she started out wanting to be Dostoevsky, and she more or less drank herself into arrests and suicide attempts. And then she gave birth, and the birth of her child filled her with a sense of love and joy, which made her a Catholic. And then she spent her life really in rigorous self-scrutiny, wanting to not only serve the poor, but embrace poverty as a way of life, to live purely. And her aggressive effort, while sometimes self-punishing, is kind of inspiring. And my students who are, wired to get Rhodes Scholarships, were gripped by this alternative way of living.
Yeah. It's interesting that you you asked them to see if there's a book that will help them with their life. One of the things I like about it, this book, is that it's not a self-help book, at least not in any facile sense. And in a way, it's difficult to think of it as a self-help book, because you're talking about the benefits of suffering, right? You're talking about benefits, how suffering kind of enlarges the soul and creates empathy. But I don't think you're suggesting to your readers that they go out and find things to suffer. I mean, I'm the father of two very young children, so I feel like I've got the suffering covered. But, if you haven't suffered, how are you going to achieve these things that suffering gives you?
Well, one of my students, who was actually now here at Oxford, said after taking the class, he said, this class has made me much sadder. And that was a high compliment. That was a victory for me. But I tell them, and occasionally a student will say, should I go out and find some suffering? And I generally say, don't worry, it'll come. It's like, that'll happen. And you can do love. Love is better. Fall in love.
And then the suffering comes. Maybe that's just me. And can you talk a bit about, I love this distinction you make about between a passion and a calling or a vocation. Yeah. And this idea of we live in a society that celebrates the big me, this kind of, I'm beautiful inside, it's just a question of self-expression. The difference in particular between a calling and a passion, what's...
Yeah, I think a passion, presumably there's something burning inside in all of us to do, but people have actually studied this, and of 22-year-olds, 80% do not know what their passion is. And so there's nothing burbling up inside there. And so a vocation is really an identity. And so for some people, for me, I was lucky. It happened very early. At age 7, I read a book called Paddington the Bear, and I knew I wanted to be a writer ever since. And that's literally true, and there's probably not been 100 days since I was 7 that I haven't done some form of writing.
Wow.
And so it's just a huge advantage to know early on, because you can get your 10,000 hours of practice in really early.
Yeah.
My joke is that in high school I wanted to date a woman named Bernice, and she didn't want to date me. She dated some other guy. And I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy. But she had other criteria. So, if you've got a vocation, you're joining an institution. So if you're a teacher, you're joining the institution of teaching, and that institution has been there before you were born. It'll be there after you're dead. Inherent in that institution is standards of excellence, and you merge yourself into that institution. And there could be years as a teacher where you're really not that happy. But you have no choice, because you are a teacher. That is your identity. And you'll put more into your profession than you take out of it for some time. But that's so core to your identity. And I will say this, one general thing I learned writing the book was I used to think that character was this little Victorian iron figure of self-control inside. But I came to realize that none of the characters in the book were strong enough to defeat their weaknesses on their own. They all needed something outside. And the people of great character, it's not because they have great self-discipline. It's because they have an amazing ability to commit to other things. So Eliot had an amazing ability to commit to love. Perkins, this amazing ability to commit to her job, Day, this amazing ability to commit totally to her faith. And so it's the ability to form commitments. And I will say that's one thing I worry about a great deal now, because the internet is a vast decommitment device, because there's just so much going on that it's so easy to shift over into something else, even to shift attention over. And so I think it's harder these days to commit just because our attention is flitting around all the time, including my own.
And I wonder if also the other thing that sort of makes it difficult to commit is just the structure of the economy. In advanced economies, you know, the long-term job, the job for life, and the institutions that aren't sort of publicly owned institutions tend to be a bit more ruthless with their employees than they used to be. So I'm just going to read a brief passage here where you talk about this relationship with the institution. A person's social function defines who he or she is. The commitment between a person and an institution is more like a covenant. It is an inheritance to be passed on and a debt to be repaid. And I think that whole passage is beautiful, but it did make me wonder if, you know, a lot of employers are not interested in that covenant anymore. Yeah. So how are you kind of...
Yeah, well, I did a story from the Rhondda Valley in Wales. And by the time I got there, this was 15 years ago, but there were no coal mines left.
Yeah.
But I was hungry, so I was looking for a restaurant, and there was only one restaurant in the whole valley that I could find. And it was empty. So I went to the owner and said, there's only one restaurant here, but you're empty. It was a French restaurant. Why are you empty? And he said, it's because coal miners don't eat in French restaurants. And I said, but there are no coal miners here anymore. But the identity was there, and that identity was so powerful and probably passed down generation to generation. Now it's all contingent. And a lot of our careers are, because of the way the economy is, that kind of work is contingent. And we're filled with a lot of contingent relationships, which are necessarily utilitarian. I'll do it until it doesn't make sense for me. And this was an argument we had, and they've just had in Ireland, over gay marriage. And I'm center-right, but about 20 years ago I wrote a piece, Why Conservatives Should Be For Gay Marriage. And my argument was we shouldn't only allow gay marriage, we should coerce gay marriage. If we have friends who are gay and they're together, so you getting married? And that's because we should be for relationships that are more than just contingent, but are real commitments. And that seemed to me the conservative position. It's taken about 20 years, but the American right is slowly getting there, but very slowly.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about this idea of personalism? This is about Dorothy Day, in fact. Being a personalist, Day had a suspicion of bigness, whether it was big government or big corporations. Day even had a suspicion of big philanthropy. She was constantly urging her co-workers to stay small. Start your work from where you live with the small concrete needs right around you. And I thought that was a really interesting passage and insight. And you've written about it before, that the sense that even in a kind of globalized world, the people who succeed and are very distinctive are people who kind of understand the particularity of where they come from.
And so she was running this by the end of her life. It was a big series of homeless shelters and communes, but she insisted on being in the front line of her profession. So she was the one sitting at the tables and serving the food to the homeless people. She lived with the homeless shelters herself. She had no privacy. She was surrounded by a lot of mental illness, but she needed to be on the front lines and to have the daily contact with people.
Yeah.
And that's something a lot of us face in our careers. As you move up, you can have a little impact over a lot of people or a profound impact over a few. And my job is the definition of a little impact over a lot of people. And I understand what she was getting at, because it is sort of unsatisfying. And my column, I wrote a column asking people to send in their purpose of life. And in tomorrow's newspaper, I write on some of the people who send in how they found their purpose. And one of the things that really struck me was how many said, I decided I don't want to have a big purpose in life. I just want a small local purpose. And one woman sent me that she had heard a story about a young man who had his most prized possession, and it was a battered old tin pot. And he said that this pot is the most valuable thing I have because it sends the message that not everybody needs to shine. And she said that was a clarifying moment for me. I don't need to shine. I can live in the spaces and just provide small acts of kindness. Wow. And I was struck by that theme was in many of the people who wrote into me. And that's personalism, and that's staying small and staying direct.
Great. Okay, well, we're going to take questions from you lot now. So,
David, it was a great talk, thank you. And I loved the way you ended with the hushed thing of St. Augustine's. I believe, and I'll try and keep this really brief, that we're moving from a culture of materialism to experientialism, that instead of finding happiness, identity, status and meaning in stuff, in material things, we're finding it in experiences instead. And one of the reasons for this, I think, is social media. So I was really interested when you mentioned that earlier, partly because I've got this belief, and I've kind of developing this idea, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, that social media, while in some ways it's really, it's part of the culture of personality, because it's how we present ourselves to other people. But because in some ways we're starting to define ourselves more or less by what we have, external things, and more by what we do, maybe that's doing a tough guy course or tough mudder or, you know, learning to do something, but what we do, not what we have, in some way we're moving back towards a culture of character again, because it's much more internal about who we are, away from that culture of personality. I realise that's mediated through social media, so therefore it's not perfect back to the 19th century. But this, do you see my point? Yeah, so back from that culture of personality to culture of character, and social media in some way supporting that idea.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but that strikes me as semi-plausible.
I'll take semi-plausible. Yeah. Thanks.
I'm joking. Here's what I would ask back would be, I agree about that moving toward experience. We're clearly moving to an experience economy, and research clearly shows that if you have money, buy experiences, don't buy things. That there's clear evidence that you'll be better off. And I do think social media does encourage experiences. I guess the only question I would ask is, does it encourage deep, long-term experiences or short-term cat videos? And so it, probably both. It depends on what you choose. And I did read a good study on what Facebook is doing to us. And the conclusion of this study was, it's not what Facebook is doing to us, it's what we bring to Facebook. If you bring deep friendships to Facebook, you use Facebook to augment your friendships. If you're lonely, you can use Facebook to mask your loneliness. But Facebook is not the thing doing it. It's what you are doing with the technology, not the technology itself.
Okay.
Thanks.
Next question. So you had a question.
My name's Kelly Burks, and I'm the head of External Relations at Initiatives of Change. I loved your talk and so many important things you mentioned. I was really impressed that I never heard the word spirituality or awareness, although I think they seem quite relevant to everything you were talking about. And certainly in my own experience, something that's been very important in my own development is to being able to accept pain as a teacher. You talked about suffering and how it helps people to develop. So what I wanted to ask you was how important a part do spirituality and awareness play in the importance of character?
Yeah. Thank you. My observation is that I know many people who are religious and deeply spiritual who are wonderful people, and I know many atheists who are wonderful people. And so I do think it's possible to do it either or, depending on one's own temperament and makeup. And I know many people in both camps who are total schmucks.
Schmuck principle.
Yeah. I do think... I just read a book called The Spiritual Child by a psychologist at Columbia who argued that we are born with a hereditary sense of spirituality, which is not necessarily religious, it can be, but it's a sense of a transcendent realm above the material realm. And her argument is you can actually measure this in children, and you can measure it in twin studies by some portion of it is hereditary. And her argument is that it's in childhood, and children have a natural sense of the sacred. If they find a squirrel who's dead, they know something sacred is there, and they will give it a respectful burial. But she says it spikes in adolescence. And she says depression is more or less normal in adolescence as we go through identity issues. And that spiritual awareness spikes at the same time as depression, as danger of depression. And that it's almost like a natural antidote to the depression that comes typically in the teenage years. And she says those who have a higher sense of spirituality are much less likely, I think she had 70% less likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, which can be used to fill that void. And then those who have a deeper spiritual awareness, they go through the depression, they're less likely to have it recur in their 20s. And so her argument is that there is a natural sense of transcendence, which should either be attached to God or to nature or just a sense of oneness. And I just observe in the world most human beings throughout history have had that sense. I think if Augustine was here, he would be speaking a language I don't know if it's understood. But if he was here, he would say it's not enough. You need religion and a creed and a direct message from God. But that's not my job. I'm a secular writer, not a religious one.
Hello. Thanks very much for your talk. I'd like to say I think you are developing your glow.
That's just a tan.
I don't know how much you know about the education system here. Schools have been under the cosh for several years now because of inspection routines that we have. It's been just this year, Ofsted, who's our inspection machine, is adding character as something that they're going to be measuring in schools. How well are schools developing character? It's a result of something that Anthony Seldon has been talking about a lot. I'm a school governor myself, and I wonder how you think we can avoid the pitfall of character now being commodified and measured, because I can see it coming already, and it does the opposite of what you're talking about and what so many of us are wanting to be, you know, wanting to bring back to schools, but this measuring thing is going to possibly work against us.
Yeah. My first thing is I would like to take the word character out of that. So they're not measuring character. Character is a moral quality. I think what they're trying to measure is resilience and grit and things that actually help you in your career. And the word character has migrated from an Adam 2 world to an Adam 1 world. And so now character is just those things that help you get ahead. And I reject that migration. And so if they want to measure self-control and resilience and grit, I'm fine with that, I guess. But I object to the demoralization of it. The second thing I would say is, if we remember those people who helped form us, it's rarely what they said. There's a letter in here from a veterinarian who wrote to me, and it was a letter that moved me a lot. He said, you can't teach character in a classroom to students who are distracted by a million other things. He said, what a wise person says is the least of that which they give. What gets communicated is the totality of their action, which has been passed down to them by a mentor years before. And then he said, the message is the person. And so when we think of their teachers, what we remember about our teachers who formed us were not what they said, but the way they were, and their attitude, and their love. And so, again, I'm not a theologian, I'm not Catholic, but when I think of Pope Francis, I'm impressed. The message is the person. It's just the way he is. And so I would hate to see I think our education reforms go askew every time we abstract from the elemental fact of education, which is the individual love between a teacher and a student. And if we try to commodify it or restructure the schools, we're missing the core fact. And we can commodify that core relationship and do damage to it, I think.
Okay, so as I said at the beginning, we also have an audience on social media, and they've been listening to us being rude about them. So we better give them a question.
Yeah, so there's been quite an active discussion on Twitter, as you'd be pleased to find out. There are three questions. The first one is from Emma Taylor. How can a commitment to social action, helping others, volunteering, build character? The second one is both from Michael Cillian. Is any kind of mentor important to build character? And how should young and older people go about to get a mentor?
The way to get a mentor is through sycophancy. First on the second one, how do you get him? I got a mentor, he came to me. I didn't go to him. So you hope, I think the responsibility is on the older person to be the mentor and to take the time. My students are very good at attracting mentors, and they're really good at kissing up to people. So I think that probably works. May not be the most rich experience, but... But I think it's more incumbent on the older people to assert the mentorship. As for the social impact, I'd say two things. First, doing volunteering and doing good for the world should not be confused with internal development. That is to say, when I ask my students what they're doing to develop their character, they always say, well, I'm doing community service. I ask them about something internal, and they answer with something external. And we all have been in the world of the NGOs, and sometimes the NGO world is a really ugly world filled with really ugly people. And sometimes even the city or finance is filled with some wonderful people. So it's not if you're working for Oxfam or Greenpeace, it doesn't necessarily make you a good person. And so I would just not confuse the external with the internal. But I will say, in the case of, say, of Dorothy Day or of Frances Perkins, who I mentioned, who were doing community service, they had a moral ecology, so they understood what their weakness was, and they sought to heal it through service. And so for Day, it was a natural selfishness and an aloofness, and she would just force herself to sit at table and talk to somebody who needed conversation against her own predilection to just be self-contained. And for Perkins, it was an unemotionalism, and she just forced herself to conduct relationships in a way that would get her out of herself. And one of the nice stories I like about Perkins is by the time she was in her late 70s, she was self-contained still a little, and she was lonely. She still had to work, so she taught at Cornell University to make some money. But she was living alone, as usual, and a frat house, a fraternity, invited her to come live with them, a bunch of guys. And she said she was as happy as a bride on her wedding night. So she's 77. She's living with all these college students. They're getting drunk around her. She's sipping bourbon at the parties with the music going on all around her. And so that was still her. And so the point is, it's not necessarily what business you're in, but the quality of relationships she was cultivating within whatever business she was in.
Bruce Lloyd, just an aside to start with. There's a lot more discussion these days about values, and I wonder whether that's an important change. But the question I would like to ask is that the title of the talk is The Importance of Character. The title of the book is The Road to Character. Most of the discussion seems to me to be about teaching and learning around character. But strangely enough, and I haven't read the book, but I quickly looked at the long index, the two words teaching and learning aren't mentioned. And I just wondered whether perhaps even the next book is learning character.
Well, I guess the supposition is that it's a journey and that all of us are on the journey, and this book was a product of my attempt to have a journey. And so I can't imagine we'd meet someone and they would say, well, my character's done. I am happy with myself. Well, we would, but they'd be in politics. So I think it's always an ever-present journey that one is on, which involves teaching, learning, relationship, and hopefully deepening.
I'm sad to say that we've run out of time. We could go on for quite a long time, I think, with many more questions. But thank you all for coming, and thank you for your excellent questions. Please note that The Road to Character is on sale outside, and please do join me once again in saying thank you to David Jordan.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.